Hey everyone, thanks for tuning in for Breakpoint. Before we get on to the actual episode, just wanted to make sure that you know and to take advantage of, if you scroll a little bit further down on the page, it's this little form that says, gets you to fill out your information. And basically what that's gonna do is get someone from our team to contact you guys on how to be the Visual Studio champion in your organization.
Pretty cool.
Yeah, super quick form, just five or so fields. Submit that and we'll get in touch with you. That's about it. So see you on the show shortly.
Go champs.
All right, here we are, September's Breakpoint.
Yay.
So excited. I was saying to him, we were watching the feed and it was like the Xbox commercial. And I'm saying, okay, Paul, we're coming right up right after the Xbox commercial.
Yes.
We really need to be like just as exciting as the Xbox peeps.
Yes, that's where we're going to talk about data.
Data, of all things. Yeah. Right. Awesome. Okay, so, but before we do that, just in case, I don't know if any of you have happened to have noticed, we've done a little bit of redecorating here in the studio. You like?
Yeah.
All nice and new look and stuff like that. So, we're going to talk about data today. Now, same thing as last month, where we were going on about, hey, you know, the role of the architect, and it's one of those things where you really don't get too much of that in Visual Studio, right? And so, or when people think of Visual Studio, you don't inherently think architect.
Not normally, yeah, I would agree with that.
Right, so that's why last month's show was awesome, because we kind of explored all these different areas that typically you wouldn't. Now, I'm willing to bet that this is probably just around the same level, if not probably even less talked about than the architecture stuff.
Yeah, it's probably around the same level is what I would say. It's interesting because when you talk about data architecture, when you talk about things such as DBAs and things of that nature, they had their own sort of set of tools as to how they do business, right? So when I was a developer, usually I would talk to the DBAs. They were using tools like Toad, if you're familiar with that and things. And
so you know, the clever names.
Yeah, it's interesting, right? And whatever else. But they did the trick. But I think there's something to be said about some flow within the tools that you use and having a familiarity with the development tools that you're using. Because frankly, when you're building software, why not have a common set of tools that make sense across the team to help you do what you need to do? And I think that's really what we're trying to get across today.
For sure. And you know what the crazy part about it too is that I think back, I don't know, probably what, two versions ago from Visual Studio.
Yep.
You know, I was going back and forth between Visual Studio and between SQL Server Management Studio and then back and forth and some other tools. And by the time all is said and done to get all of your data stuff done, you're working with five different tools.
Yep.
Right? So if I'm not mistaken, you're going to rock our world today and you're going to show us how we're all going to do it all in one.
That is the intent.
Okay. So that's the pressure. Remember, this is a live show, so you guys feel free to keep shooting back at us different things that you want to see Paul do. And for those of you guys that are actually new to watching the show, since this is technically season two, yay for us, we got re-signed, eh?
Yeah, that's
must
right.
Must have been a successful season one. But again, one of the things that I always love doing is trying to make sure that he, you know, does things as much ad hoc as possible. So if there's anything that you want to see that he's not talking about, just let us know in the chat and we'll go through it.
Yeah, sounds like a plan.
All right. So let's do it.
Let's do it. Yeah. The one thing I do like to do with these episodes, though, if you've noticed, is I try to blend a little bit beyond just the technology and doing, you know, the demos that you see and really talk about some of the concepts behind things. Just because I think it actually makes a lot of sense to talk about the reasons why we do things first and why things are done the way they are. And so I want to talk a little bit first about this first question that we see here, and it should be up there. Yep. Is what is the most important component of any application? Anybody?
If you ask me, I'm going to say the UX.
Okay, that's wrong.
But I know that that's totally not what you were trying to get at.
But although you might have UX architects that might think differently, but
fair
this
enough.
Is my own opinion.
Fair enough. I'm just saying that if you're going to look at what's important to the user, so you didn't qualify what's the most important part.
Yeah.
Right? So we're just going to see. We're going to get that back to them. I had to redo it. There we go.
Okay. We back?
Yeah.
Okay. So the question that was asked before was, what's the most important component of any application? So I don't know if there's any sort of answers here. I'd be very curious to see if there's answers on the feed. So the most important part, component of any application is, what do you think, Jonathan?
Okay, so I know that if I said UX, you're gonna tell me I'm wrong.
No, you're wrong.
In theory, then, the next one would be business layer, which technically, I'm assuming, given what we're talking about today, would still be wrong. So I'm gonna go with data.
And you're wrong.
Oh. Okay. So here I was trying to outsmart you.
But. Yeah, no, you're wrong. So anyways, this is my opinion anyways.
Okay.
And if you have any sort of ideas as to what you think it might be, feel free to answer. But it's actually not data, it's information. So if you think about what we use software for, and I've used this slide in the past. Now, I didn't bring up this slide for this presentation, but what is the difference between data and information?
See, now you're putting me up all on the spot,
yeah.
And we're supposed to be asking these guys here.
Well, you can ask them too and see what they say, but here's the way I look at it. Data is a set of facts, right?
Right.
It can be static, it can be dynamic, it can be whatever, but it only becomes useful to you as an end user when it becomes available to you to make a decision on, and that's when it becomes what I call information, and that's kind of what you call information architecture. It's the whole idea behind the definition between data going to information and all those types of things. So there's actually a really good book by an author by the name of James Gleick. He wrote a book called Chaos, which was all about chaos theory and things, which was kind of cool. If you haven't read it, I do suggest you read it if you're a science buff, because it was actually pretty cool to see how chaos theory sort of came into being. But there's this new book that he brought out called The Information, which is really a history of information, which kind of sounds really, really kind of dry. But he actually brought it into a process by saying how information has evolved from, you know, the earliest of civilizations all the way to today in the internet age. So it's a really good understanding and a really good read, because it actually makes you understand why data becomes information and how information becomes important to you. So it's really about making sure that you do the right things to make that data useful to your end users. So part of that is building your application right. So you talked about the business layer and the ability to actually build your business logic appropriately, and how the process flow happens within the application, and how that process flow actually, helps with the business processes that you have in place already, whether they're manual or otherwise. Then you also have the user experience layer, which you talked about as well, and how that experience actually drives information. So for example, we have modern user interface within Windows 8 and Windows Phone, as well as some of our other products coming out there. And really, that's all built on information architecture. The intent is not to show you these squares that are orange versus purple versus blue, and the fact that they're, you know, rectangles versus squares instead of, say, circles and things. It's really to bubble up information so that you as an end user can make a decision quickly as to what you can do with that. A good example would be a live tile, right? So if you think about a weather application, might have a live tile, and that live tile might say, you know, it's, 15 degrees Celsius out there, and, you know, it's going to have a probability of precipitation of, say, 60%. Well, then you probably need a coat and you probably need an umbrella, right? So right away, without even getting into the application, you could see right away that there's useful information that you can act upon and make a decision on. And that's really what we're trying to do with software. Software is not a tool that we build just because we want to build it. We actually build software so we can get an end answer and make a decision to do something else. And really, that's the real value of why we get data, why we have content, and why we actually send that content to our end users in a lot of ways. And it is, to be honest, the most valuable component of any IT sort of system, if you think about it. You know, you talk about businesses needing that competitive edge. And there's actually another good book out there called, I forget the name of it, but I read it just a while ago. It was really, really good, about high-speed trading and how it was really important for some of these high-speed traders, in order to make a lot of money as to what they were doing, to get that information on stock trades and to find stock quote information more quickly than their competitors, so that they could get that competitive advantage, so that they could get the lower price on the stock before it went up because, you know, somebody else bought the stock and therefore the stock goes up, for example. So those types of things are very valuable to companies and to end users as well, because it allows them to have that competitive edge and to make the right decisions more often than the wrong decisions. And that's really why we do things the way we do in software development, to try and drive the right behaviors for our end users so that they can actually build those types of things. Right?
Absolutely.
All right. So that's basically what we're saying here. We build applications because we want to drive data into being information. So how do you do that? Well, it's a combination of a whole bunch of different things. And one of those things is, for example, creating the right architecture for your application so that the data is presented to the user in the right way. So rather than just being a table of information, maybe you actually provide business intelligence. So a good example of some of this stuff would be what we're doing with Power Pivot and Power BI, I should say. So this is a new sort of offering in the cloud that Microsoft is bringing out that pairs up with Excel to get large amounts of data and actually derive insights from that data. And that's a good example of one way that you can actually derive a lot of really good information and drive the right behavior for your end user so that he or she can make the right decision that way. Another way that you have is one of the Visual Studio Online tools that we have called Application Insights, which we talked about in an earlier episode. If you're interested to know more about it, it's our analytics platform. And as we talked a little bit about that, if you remember or if you've heard of Application Insights before, there's three main things that Application Insights does. One, it provides you with information on the health of your application, which is, you know, table stakes for app analytics software. Is your application healthy enough to do things? Is it crashing on certain things or whatever? Two, is it performing? So beyond the health of the application, is it actually performing the way it should be and things like that? And then three, and the third part I think is the most important part to Application Insights, it's insightful information into user behavior onto how your applications are being used. So if you think about this from that perspective, Application Insights is a tool to help you as a software developer and as a software development team really understand the user behavior of your application in the wild, in production, if you will, and really sort of get an understanding of exactly what the user is using within your application. Because, and this is true, I can count to sort of several different sort of instances in my own career where, you know, you've built this application, you've architected it, and you have a lot of information and you have a lot of focus on a specific set of functionality within your application. And it ends up that the user is not using that part of the application, but instead they're using this sort of esoteric page of the application that you never knew was important to them, but they spend 80% of their time on. So that in itself is very, very important information to you as a software development team because it allows you to focus your efforts on exactly what you need to do next. So I think that's something to keep in mind. And it doesn't necessarily mean it has to be an end user that's using the application data and things like that from a business intelligence perspective. It's also how do you use data as a software development team and things like that, right?
Absolutely. So, the big question?
Yes.
No, go ahead.
Oh, I thought you were setting me up.
Nope.
So the big question is, how do you manage your data? And when is it relevant and when does it go stale, right? So before we actually get into demos and things like that, I want to talk about something that I call, we talked about application lifecycle management. And we've done this several times in Microsoft's Visual Studio platform has a number of different tools that are available to you to manage the lifecycle of your application from, you know, birth to death, if you will. Or I guess you could say from birth to sunsetting.
Negative way of looking at it.
Yes. End of life.
Evolution.
Evolution. The evolution.
It's always positive.
Yes. Yes. Come absolutely.
On. Anyway.
It's all good.
Stuck on words. It's yes. All good.
But there's also something called data lifecycle management. And I want to touch on this because I think it's a very important component of the application itself. And we talked about the application being a vehicle for the information, right? To provide you as an end user information. Well, data has a life cycle as well, and you have to really understand exactly when that is relevant and when it is not. So the first thing to understand is that when you build an application, data is an entity unto itself. Now that sounds like kind of weird stuff right there, but it's basically, in the definition that I have on underneath is basically, it's independent of the business process and activity. So if you think about it, the data that you have or that you've gathered throughout the process of using an application or, you know, from various different data feeds, it doesn't matter about the business process that's implemented on the application that's using it or the activity that's done on the actual app data itself. It's an entity, and as such, it also has a life cycle as part of it as well. Data governance is a really, really big component of many organizations today. It's a big, big problem for a lot of organizations, not in the sense that they don't know what to do, but they do spend a lot of effort as to making sure that the right data is getting to the right people, that you don't send data that is, for example, sensitive to certain people because maybe it's got some security around it that needs to be upheld. But beyond that, you also have things around policies, right? So making sure that, you know, you have the right set of data retention. And things like this include beyond just a database. Like, for example, at Microsoft, we have data retention policies even on our own email.
True. And SharePoint and TFS too, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
On source code.
Yeah.
Maybe that's more procedural than it is from a tooling perspective.
Well,
but
yes and no. I don't know the specifics around that. I probably should, but certainly on you know things like email, we have you know retention policies as to how long we're supposed to keep that on our machines or in the cloud, for example, for Office 365 accounts.
Yeah.
But you know there is a life cycle to that, and
or more importantly, there should be.
Yeah,
right?
Because
we have it. I don't know that everyone else does, and that's actually part of the point, right?
Yeah, because and businesses talk about this all the time. It's risk, right? So what is the risk of keeping stale information? Whether that means that you're making decisions based on the wrong sets of data. You know, is data no longer accurate anymore and things like that so that, you know, you're making, you know, bad sets of software or something like that? Or
decisions.
You're
doing it from
exactly,
a BI perspective.
Right. Yeah, So figuring out exactly what's important to you is really, really important to your organization as well when it comes to data. So,
and for the record, if I may add, that's one of those things that you really want to think about before getting into, too far down into requirements, too far down into build and stuff like that, just because, at least I found in my experience, and somehow we always, every episode, we get into the back in the day, right? So back in the day.
It's the best way to talk about things because I like to say the things that were, you know, a pain in the butt for me, right?
Well,
you know, and things
like
that.
That's the thing. So you couldn't have said it better myself. I think back to some of the projects that we were doing.
Yep.
And for whatever reason, we always talked about data as it kind of came up in applications or stuff like that versus what do we actually need to know? What do we actually care about? Figuring out all of these things beforehand and then starting to write the software.
Yes.
And it boggled my mind because then you have to put in the change requests and all that kind of stuff. And then all of a sudden your budget goes from like being probably just a bit over, let's be honest, most projects are a bit over budget, to like this much over budget because you had to redo it several times simply because you didn't think about these things beforehand.
That's why data architecture and information architecture are so important
and
really have to be done right at the very beginning of the project. You know, like when you talk about the beginning of the project, requirements come first, right?
Yeah.
So what are you trying to build for your software?
But this does go into the requirements.
Absolutely.
Right.
It's a piece of the puzzle that you need to absolutely take care of. So that's actually a good segue into the next slide, which is the United States Geological Survey group. So I was surfing the internet to find good examples of data lifecycle management, and this came up, and I thought this was actually really, it was a simple process. I mean, the devil's in the details, obviously, but the USGS comes across this. They have lots of data that they use. So if you think about what the USGS does, they basically keep data on earthquakes and, you know, tectonic shift and all that kind of stuff, right? So very large sets of data, if you will, right? Because they're always on, you know, getting information and they're setting this into their database. So they have to have a very strong set of policies around when data is accurate, when you actually shelve it and all those types of things. And this was an example of how this actually makes sense, right? So the first component to this is planning, like what we talked about, right?
Especially with a data set like this.
Yeah.
Right?
Right? So, you know, how are you going to make use of this application data, or this data, I should say? How are you going to actually, you know, input it into the application so that it comes out as information, right? So a good example of this is, you know, predictions of earthquakes and stuff like that. How do you actually get earthquake predictions from past data? Well, you make insights based on the data that's in front of you. So you know, using the scientific method and you postulate and all those types of things, right?
That's where it gets, you know, beyond my head.
No,
I'm a business guy.
Yeah,
you know, like if we're talking business apps, line of business apps, I'm there. When we're talking crazy data and stuff like that, I'll leave that with you.
Yeah. It's all good. And so like planning to understand exactly the capacity that you're going to need to support the data, you know, how you're going to retain that data and all those types of things are really, really important. And also, what is the format that you're going to store this data? Is it a database? Is it a flat file? I mean, those are implementation details in a lot of ways, but how are you actually going to manage this data from, you know, the storage standpoint too is very important. Then you have acquisition, and that's also really important, right? So how do you acquire this data? Is it from sensors? Is it from various different feeds? How are you actually going to merge these feeds together into a single spot? So this is more around implementation of integration of systems and things like that, right? Yeah. So maybe you have a very simple system that has only a single data feed. Okay, that's good. But then the acquisition phase is probably going to be a very simple component of your lifecycle management. But in other cases, in most cases, when you're talking about business, it's multiple different spots. So Right. You come from the banking industry before
sure
Microsoft.
Sure do. That was my previous life, yes.
So, I mean, core banking software, if you think about
tons
it.
Tons of different data
right?
sources.
So I've talked to many different banks in my consulting days and stuff like that. The one view of the customer that
does not exist.
It doesn't exist because it's really hard to do. And the reason for that is because everybody in every single line of business within a bank has mm-hmm. different views on what mm-hmm. a customer is, and sometimes they conflict.
Yep.
Right? So how do you actually manage that? That's a good example of how you deal with those types of things. Thinking through that can early on can help you in your project later on. It's kind of like bugs, right?
Yep.
Finding your bugs early
yep.
is a whole lot less expensive than it would be down the road.
With one addition to that is that you have to also make sure that you're being, and I hate to throw the word out there because, you know, obviously naturally it's a buzzword, but as much as you have strict requirements, you also have to be agile enough in order to make sure that when you bring in new data sources, that everything that you're doing actually takes that into account.
Yeah, leverage your synergies by getting the whole low-hanging fruit. I'm just using buzzwords there. So, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Yes.
All right, the next step, process. So this is the process by which you acquire that data and how you store that data, right? So what is the process by which you actually retain that data into your data storage and how you manage that type of data going forward. So that's obviously an important component to it. Then you have analysis, right? So data doesn't become information until you analyze it, for example. So the analysis phase is how do you actually make that data useful to the end user? And that's not an easy question to answer
Never
in a lot
is.
Of ways, right? Sometimes it is, depending on the size of the system and the complexity of it, but in a lot of cases it's not, using the core banking example, right? The one view of a customer, you know, different sort of disparate views of the same customer. The bank only has that one customer, for example, across all these different lines of business, but they all treat that customer in a different way.
True.
So finding the information and getting the information and set up in the proper way is really, really important.
And also scoping it down to what its intention is, right? Because even when you analyze the same data set, this is the part that killed me, is that it was always the same data set that we were looking at, but every different division or any different group or whatever had a different perspective
yep.
of the same data.
Oh.
So that analysis that you're doing, keep in mind, is not just analysis of this is the data as it is. It's analysis of the data as it is within the context that you're going to use it.
Agreed.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah. It's absolutely crazy sometimes thinking some of this stuff. It'll blow up your brain sometimes. So
he's like, I'm just talking about it. My brain's already.
I know. It hurts. It hurts.
Sounds like it's almost demo time then.
Getting there. Yeah. then we also have the preservation side of things, right? So once you've actually analyzed that data, became information and things like that, what do you actually do to preserve that data? What are the policies around retention and things like that? So those are the things that you also have to think about. And then the final component to that is once you've actually managed to get the information, the value out of that data, how do you publish that data into, or the information as it were? Or how do you share it? Now, for the USGS, because it's a public sector business, if you will, from the U.S. government, they share that information publicly, or at least some of it, anyways. So that is something that they have to make sure. Maybe they, share it via open data, which is something that I think would probably be is something that they actually do. But maybe it's an internal company then that you don't want to share that data, but how do you share it between lines of business and things like that? So understanding exactly what the policies, the processes around that is very, very important as well. And then describing all those things underneath is, how do you get the metadata? So describe the actual information. This is across the entire spectrum of that process. How do you manage the quality? Quality is a really, really tough thing to manage when you're talking about data, especially when you're talking about merging different sort of data sources. Again, that one banking scenario, for example. Mm-hmm. How do you know that you don't have duplicate records and things like that? There are tools out there that help you with that, but that's outside of the scope of what we're going to be talking about today. But it is something that you have to manage as well. And it does take a lot of effort to understand your data properly and to really manage the quality, because that becomes an issue down the road. And then obviously from the retention standpoint, how do you back it up? How do you secure it? You know, what is the process by which you destroy that data and all those types of things? So just something to think about. This is just one example of a data lifecycle management process. There's no one right answer, but I thought this one was a good one to describe exactly how you manage the process of dealing with your data. Now, the next segue is around how you help developers turn data into information, right? So this is the part where we talk about doing some demos, so we get into some more fun stuff too. And the intent here is just really to show you some of the cool things that the Visual Studio team has done with the SQL Server team in conjunction to create a really good sort of, I like to call it seamless, even though it's a buzzword, a seamless
I
sort of...
I didn't say we weren't allowed using buzzwords
at
all.
Yeah, I don't like using them, although I probably use them way too much. It is.
No offense to anyone out there that's, you know, very agile friendly, but...
A scrum master or whatever, yes.
Yeah. I don't want any tweets afterwards saying I said something bad. All I'm saying is that it's just a little bit overused. So, you know, a little like kind of like HD.
That's why I like to use the word nimble.
Okay. Done. Yes. Just for the record, we're developers. We're not English majors. So use as you please.
Unto myself, thou art. No, okay.
Yes. It's okay. We're taking a breakpoint for Visual Studio, not Webster.
Okay. All right. So let's talk about the data tooling within Visual Studio. Enough's enough. All right, there's a few things here that I think are really, really interesting. The one component, and we're going to spend most of our time on the first and third component here, which is the first one is SQL Server Data Tools. So SSDT for short. You may have heard of these things before because they're not necessarily new, but at the same time, not a lot of developers actually know about them. So there's been a change in how we do things within Visual Studio 2013 compared to previous versions. So the SSDT tooling, I think, came out with the introduction of Visual Studio 2010. So it's, you know, around 5 years old now, I think. And the interesting thing about it is it gained a lot of popularity among DBAs and data professionals because it allowed them to sort of interact with their development teams in a more sort of integrated fashion, if you will. And it allowed them to use Visual Studio to manage their databases, which was kind of cool, right? But it was an add-on. So basically what happened was, you know, like you got Visual Studio 2010 or you got Visual Studio 2012, and then you would have to go to the website, the SSDT blog, for example, go to the link that the download was at, you download the tooling, and then you're good to go. And that tooling was specific to the specific version of Visual Studio, right? So you couldn't download the
visuals. I may have learned that one the hard way.
Yeah. So what we've done with Visual Studio 2013 is it's still an add-on, so it's not out of the box, but part of what we've done with Visual Studio is we've really integrated the whole update feature into the software itself. So if you go to tools, you know, and go to the I forget the exact thing, but it's in tools and you go to get new software and things like that, updates. You can actually find it there, and you can download it. And then as new updates for the actual tooling come out, you can actually have it so that it automatically updates for you so it does it in the background. So there's a lot of good value there. So that's one of the ways that we try to make it as easy as possible for you as a developer to get information or to get the tooling that you need to do your data development. The third one is SQL Server within Microsoft Azure. Mm-hmm. And again, we're Microsoft, we will talk about Microsoft Azure any chance we can.
And for the record, I have our little two clouds here to remind us.
Yes, absolutely.
That all of this stuff works with different things in Azure, too.
How symbolic of you.
Well, that and when Paul stresses me out, I kind of feel the need to just sit there and squeeze.
It's funny, you were doing that quite a bit this morning.
I may have been. Mm. But.
All right. Okay.
I'm just going to keep squeezing. You keep doing your thing, I'm just going to keep squeezing.
Yep. And then the last component, which I probably won't get into, but you can actually do a search for some of this stuff on MSDN. We actually have some processes that you can make use of within Visual Studio around data anonymity. So one of the things that, and again, talking back to one of my previous engagements when I was a consultant, I did some work for the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania in their Health and Human Services Department. And we were building an application that was really, really focused on health information for various different people with disabilities. And so obviously very sensitive information.
Very complex information.
Complex information too, because it actually changed. Well, the use of it changed from year to year because legislation changed and things like that too, right? So testing those systems became a challenge because of the fact that we had to use as close to real data as possible
without using real data,
without using personal information or identifiable information. So we had to get some manual sort of stuff and some batch scripts to actually anonymize data and all that kind of stuff. Very painful stuff, and was very serious if there was a breach, right? Yep. Because it's private data and it's health data, which is obviously quite sensitive. So as a result, we had to do a lot of effort just to do that. But there's actually some processes that you can use within Visual Studio to anonymize your data so that you don't have to worry about that as much. So you can create stored procedures, or not stored procedures, but methods within your project to actually
generate
data and things like that.
I was going to say, make sure you have enough budget for testing data, because people don't do that either.
Oh, my goodness.
Now you just solved that problem.
Yeah, exactly, right? So it's a great feature. I don't think we talk about it enough, but it's something that is available to you.
Nice.
So let's talk about that. So we're going to talk about SSDT, and we'll talk about Azure at the same time as well. So let's actually do that, get out of this, and we'll get into Visual Studio.
Drum roll, please.
Boom, boom. Okay, so we're in Visual Studio. I'm in the Ultimate Edition of 2013, Update 3. Although this works on, what I'm going to show you works on any of the paid SKUs, so Professional, Premium, and Ultimate. The first thing I want to show you is the Server Explorer. Now, the Server Explorer has been around forever, right? So if you take a look at the Server Explorer, you have, for example, here, your data connections. You have Microsoft Azure connections as well, if you take a look at it. So this is pretty typical, and it's nothing too interesting, because you've probably seen this before, and you probably use it on a day-to-day basis if you're an enterprise developer, for example, right? So for example, here, I could actually go into SQL databases and refresh it. It's asking me for my password, so I'll put in my password, do not look. There we go. Oh, of course, I changed my
password. Apparently you didn't look either.
No, I changed my password, actually.
Sure you did. I did. It worked yesterday. That's what they all say.
I changed it last night, that's why. So there you go. So you can see, for example, I have two SQL server databases in Azure itself. So right there, that's kind of cool. You know, I can take a look at that. But that's not really the SSDT components. This is just something that's, you know, built in out of the box. What I want to show you is the SQL Server Object Explorer. So if you're using SQL Server, it's actually one of the more powerful things that you can see here. So for example, I have a bunch of local DB projects here, and I also have even my Azure database that I've got set up here as well. So let's take a look at what some of this stuff is.
Whoa, pausing for a second.
Yep.
You totally glossed on a really awesome, well, at least I think it's awesome, right? Being, you know, here I am stressing.
You know what, I forgot to put on Zoom It. So while you do that, I'm gonna put Zoom It on.
Okay, you do that. So you know what, I'm gonna turn off your screen. How's that?
Okay.
So you got all excited and stuff like that, but one of the coolest things for me is that you had SQL Server and the SQL databases on Azure all in one spot, right? Which used to be separate also, right? When back in the day when we treated this world of on-premise and cloud as separate, now that's not even an issue anymore as well. So that mentality went straight into the tooling, which I'm excited about, because I know for me at least that was confusing me back and forth to kind of switch back and forth. And the only way you knew it was Azure, it was this little blue icon that was totally obscured and you couldn't see it.
Yep.
So you have resolved my problems. I thank you very much.
You're welcome. I did.
Of course, you had nothing
myself
to do with it, but anyway, it's on the point.
Yeah, exactly.
Show us.
All right.
Show us.
So what we have here, for example, if I take a look at my PJL ALM SQL Server, which is just local on my machine right here. You can see, for example, we have our databases, and I have this Northwind database.
Of course you do.
Northwind, you know, there's pubs as well, which is, you know.
Northwind's clearly cooler.
Yeah, because it says North in it,
right?
Because we're in Canada.
Exactly. Total geek moment.
Exactly. So you can see here, for example, it's all good. You would expect to see all this stuff, right? So you have the ability to take a look at, for example, all these types of things like your tables, and I'll get back to that in a second. You can even take a look at some of the things that you might have within your application, such as your stored procedures, right? So you see all the various different stored procedures here. You can even drill into it and get the parameters and things. So it's a great visual way to actually get into your application from a data perspective. Now, getting back to, you know, what it used to be. Typically, you had to do this within, you know, SQL Server Management Studio, which is still a great tool and available to you. But if you're a developer, it's disruptive to you to actually have to go to a different tool sometimes. So actually having all of this stuff in a single tool is very, very valuable. Beyond that, there's a lot of great stuff around this as well. So if you take a look at this, for example, if I go to, say, for example, I double-click on customers, wait for this to show up. It's just querying my database. Not sure why it's taking so long, but we'll see why in a second here. Okay. So we'll make this a little bit smaller. You can see here, for example, there's all the definitions. So there's the columns, right? Allow the null. So I can actually change some of the stuff if I want to. And in fact, here's some of the information. So there's the metadata. So here are the keys, you know, any constraints that might be associated with this table, indices that might, although they call it indexes, I like to call it indices because I think that's more proper English.
Again, we get back onto the English lesson?
Absolutely. And as you can see here, for example, if you wanted to take a look at it from a SQL generation statement, you can see here, for example, you have all the various different components. Then you see here it says, you know, it's a clustered primary key and all that stuff right here, right? Yeah, I was trying to do that and it wasn't letting me for whatever reason. There we go, better. So there you go. So you get a lot of information here right away. But what's also interesting is maybe that's all well and good, but you want to do something with this, right? So what you can do is you can actually go to the Northwind database and you can just right click on it and you can say create a new project. Aha. So what we have here is you can basically say, okay, this is a project that we want to create. So I'm going to say Breakpoint loves Northwind.
And by Breakpoint, you mean Paul loves Northwind.
Well, okay.
I'm just saying.
That's fine. Create the new solution. So yeah, we'll do that as well, for example, and create a directory for it. You can even add it to source control. So this is all part of the application lifecycle management process as well. So if you want to use TFS and things like that, you can do that. Or you can use different source control methods, but TFS is definitely the way to go, obviously. So we'll
leave it at that. And TFS on-premise and also Visual Studio Online in this case.
That's right. So start this, and it's actually going to import the database. So we'll wait for this to actually import. So it's just doing it. And as you can see, the import of the schema has started. So it's actually grabbing the schema from my local database. We'll just wait for this to go a little bit. There we go.
Every episode I keep thinking that we need hold music, and I never remember it by the time we get to the next one. We'll get there. I'll remember it.
All right. Click on finish, and there you go. So basically now what you have is you have all the stored procedures, all the table definitions and things like that, so it's actually created it for you. So again, as your database evolves, because it will evolve as your system evolves, you can actually manage this and put it in source code control and all those types of things. So there's all sorts of stuff around that. So that's all well and good, but there's a whole bunch of other things that we can do here as well. So if I actually go to this and right-click on it, I can do something like a schema compare. So let's say, for example, you've been in a situation where, you know, you have your development database and you have a database in production, right, for example, and you want to make sure, okay, well, what are we changing to make sure that, you know, there's not going to break stuff? Or if it's going to break it, we know what's going to break, right?
This is the part where every time we would have to go do a deployment, my heart would start racing because it never works properly.
Exactly. So here we have, I've got the specific schema from this breakpoint, and we can select the target. So I'm going to select the target. Clear the target here. I'm not sure what's going on. And we'll save it first. Maybe that's why.
Did you set a target?
No, I didn't because it's not letting me. For whatever reason, it's not letting me. That's really unfortunate. Okay, there we go. I'm not sure why that's going. Okay, so we just switched it around. And now what I can do is I can basically say choose a database. And guess what? I can actually select Azure as an option for this as well.
Love it.
Right? So it's not just your local databases or databases within your own sort of setup. You can actually do it with this as well. So we'll not edit. That's fine. We'll test it is what I wanted to do. That's fine. Whatever. Cancel this. And click OK. Oh, of course, maybe there's a firewall issue here. Work fine in my machine at home, right?
Famous last words of every developer.
Yeah. So let's try and compare it. And what you see here, okay, so you can compare, for whatever reason, we seem to have, PGL Northwind test. For whatever reason, it's saying it's not available. So let's find out why. Select clear the source, and we'll try this again. Choose a database, and choose this one. Click OK.
Did you add the firewall rules on the Azure side?
No, I didn't, but I didn't think it was going to be an issue because we've done this stuff before. Let's see here. Okay, for whatever reason, it's not going to work, so that's really unfortunate. Okay, so we'll see what we can do to get back to that, but the intent here was to show you that you can actually find out exactly what the schema differences are between your different databases.
Right.
So what would happen here, so just picture in your mind what's happening here, is anything that's different between your tables, between your triggers and your stored procedures, your constraints and primary and foreign keys and your indices, for example, anything of that would actually be shown here, and you would actually see that there was a difference here. So let's actually see if I'm going to change this around and do it this way. I don't think this will make any difference. Yeah, it won't let me do it. So we'll clear the target. I'm going to try this one more time. Select the target.
And?
Yeah.
No, okay.
So
do.
For whatever reason, that's deciding not to work. Oh, well. That was unfortunate, but that's the way it is sometimes with live demos. But
sure is.
But the intent here is to show that you can actually do that kind of stuff and actually do your data comparison, things like that. But what you can also do, and unfortunately I won't be able to show it to you here because of the fact that it's all, you know, I seem to not have the connection to it, is you can actually even compare your data, which is also very interesting.
So schema and data.
Exactly, right? So you can actually do, for example, let's see if I can find out from here. So right click. And you can even do a data comparison here. So say,
now
for
we're
example,
doing totally ad hoc demos, aren't we?
Yeah, let's try it.
I love it.
So here's the database here. Okay, so this is my local database. And we'll choose the target. Will be this one right here. Yeah, for whatever reason, it's not deciding.
What about your other one? Oh, that would mean that they're both local.
Yeah, let's see if I can create a new. You know what? I'm going to create a whole new connection. And I'll show you how you can actually do that. That's actually a good idea. So if I actually go to Azure.com, Azure.com. And if I go to my portal, go to my account, let's see here.
Okay, see, so this stuff I like too, in that while that's loading, mm-hmm. if you think about a good place to put test databases and stuff like that, obviously not with private information or,
yep.
mind you could do that too, but let's just assume purely test data for the time being. Rather than having to necessarily have a SQL Server available to you, you could actually just go in and spin up a brand new database right in Azure, do all your testing, get rid of it, and off you go, which is technically exactly what you're going to do right now.
Exactly.
Right?
So what I have here is my PGL Northwind database that I was trying to connect to. For whatever reason, wasn't letting me to do that. And you can see here when I went into it, there's the connection string right here. So you can see here, there's my connection string. So I'm going to copy that, I should say, and we're going to put that in here. And we're going to use SQL Server authentication because you can't use Windows authentication on this thing. So I'm just going to put that in there using my account information. Well, not my account information, my SQL Server admin console password. We'll test connection and see if this thing, for whatever reason, there's a firewall issue. So that's really unfortunate. So what would happen here is, what if the firewall was letting me actually go through this, what would happen is, you know, it would actually take a look at the table that I've selected, which is the customer table, and find out exactly what the differences are in between my on-premises one that I have right here,
right.
as well as the one in the cloud. Or you could actually do a two on-premises one, or even two cloud ones.
Yeah, whatever.
As well.
So effectively, as long as it's another database, it could do the comparison.
Exactly.
Now, I'm assuming it would have to be the same schema, though.
Yes, it would be. Basically, it'll tell you that there's differences all over the place.
Cool.
Like if it was two different sort of schemas altogether, but typically that's what you would see.
Which technically would then mean that it's working properly.
Yeah,
because if it was two different databases and it told you that they were actually the same, then we'd have a bigger problem.
Exactly. Now the last thing that's interesting here is if I right click on this and I go to properties. So this is in the project itself. So I'm in the database project. And you can say basically what the target platform of this database project will be. So SQL Server 2014, which is the latest and greatest version of SQL Server. You can also choose 2012, 2008, and 2005. But you can also publish this to SQL Azure.
Nice.
So again, you can create your database on premises, and then even you can pull a database that you currently have, for example, on premises, and then you can publish that database onto SQL Azure just using the data tooling within Visual Studio. So what here you see here, for example, we can do those types of things, and then we can basically save this. And what we can do now is I can right-click on this, and I can publish it. Now, I might run into problems because...
You haven't built it yet.
Oh, built it, yes. That's the first thing I need to do is build it. So we'll build it.
Build failed.
And oh, yeah, no, that's what I expected, to be honest, because there's a few things that are wrong here, right? So you can see here that there's a number of different things that are showing up as errors. So it's saying, for example, the employee territories does not have a clustered index. Clustered indices are required for inserting data into SQL Azure. So basically, SQL Azure requires clustered indices, for example. So what we need to do now is we need to actually double-click on this and create this into a clustered index.
So basically, what you're saying is that it's actually checking everything for you, and hence exactly. The point of actually doing a publish, I guess, so that Visual Studio can actually go through and double-check all these things before you actually deploy it out.
You got it, right? So that's exactly what we're doing here. So we'll do that.
And this does it across the entire database, which is also kind of nice so that you don't have to necessarily worry about, okay, well, I don't know if that worked. I like it.
Yep. So just...
It's the little things, you know, saving a couple of minutes here and there is definitely something that I highly doubt anyone would say no to.
Exactly. So I'm just finishing this off here. So we've actually created these into clustered indices. So we've saved all that. We'll rebuild it.
And succeeded.
So now let's publish this sucker. So we'll put it here, and we'll publish.
Do you often call your database suckers?
Well, when it's giving me problems, I like to
just checking. Say I usually have more colorful names for them, but I guess
we can't use that here.
Well, we could just bleep it out. But
yes. So what we have here is, of course, this is probably not going to work because it's going to ask for the same thing. Okay, so collect that, set that database, we'll test connection. Yeah, and it's the firewall stuff. So for whatever reason, seem to be having a problem with that. But what would happen is it would publish this along with the data that was associated with it and actually publish it into SQL Azure. So again, as a developer, if you can think about this, or even as a database administrator or a data architect on the team, you can use Visual Studio, the tools that you currently have on your desktop, to actually manage your databases and the data associated with it, as well as the schemas, in various different ways, which is actually quite interesting in that way. So
I love it. I keep thinking back in the day, and that's why I kind of have to hold myself this way. I'm thinking back to the day where we literally did all of this stuff manually, mm-hmm. and then more importantly, had to, just going back to what you were saying before with the source control and everything like that, we literally had to manually keep all the different copies of all the different versions of the stored procedures and stuff like that because there was no other way to do that, really.
Yeah.
And SQL Server Management Studio doesn't connect into Visual Studio Online or TFS.
Yes.
So here you have the beauty of Visual Studio doing all that for you.
Exactly.
So your demos were cool, but I was kind of stuck on that one.
Yeah, fair enough.
For me was a big deal to begin with.
No, I know. It is a big deal. I mean, I just think about the hours that I would have saved if I actually had this kind of tooling built into Visual Studio for myself when I was actually doing this stuff. So, yeah. So unfortunately, the firewall was our bane of existence today, but that's the way it's going to be, I guess.
I guess if you look at it from a positive perspective, at least you know your databases are secure.
Yes, because they don't exist in Azure yet. That's why. Because, not because Azure is insecure, like, don't get me wrong, but because we couldn't publish anything. So if you can't publish anything, there's no footprint.
Fair enough.
Yes.
Fair enough.
Yeah. So.
Well, okay.
Yeah.
We learned a few things, nonetheless.
Absolutely. So that is actually all we have today. So I don't know if anybody has any specific questions that they want to ask on the chat or anything else like that. But happy to discuss those if you want. So
yeah.
Thank you.
Look at that. I'm going to put that full screen. There you go.
There you go.
But you know what? Again, I go back to, by the way, while you guys are putting up questions and stuff like that in the chat, and again, if you're watching this on demand afterwards, Paul and I monitor the questions that come through either on Twitter, so feel free to tweet at CDNDevs with the hashtag BreakpointCA, or if you're watching this on Channel 9 or YouTube, feel free to just post questions below and we'll tackle your questions that way.
Absolutely.
But I mean, again, to me, here's a question that I have, just popped in my head.
Yep.
You mentioned all of these things are available for Visual Studio.
Yes.
Now, is that all the versions of Visual Studio?
So Professional, Premium, Test Professional, well, Test Professional, yes, and Ultimate.
Cool. So obviously not Express.
No.
No. But the beauty of it is that with pretty much covering almost all of the different products, effectively everyone has this installed. Now, when you go in and you install Visual Studio, that's not an additional SDK or something that you have to install, right? It just installs on its own.
Yeah, it installs on its own. I mean, it's with Visual Studio 2013, it's actually part of the process. So I'll show you exactly where this is, to be honest. I've already got it installed, so I can't install it again. But you go to Tools, you go to Extensions and Updates, and you can see here there's a whole bunch of things. So you could actually see, for example, SSDT. Maybe it'll show up like that. No, so SQL Server Data Tool. Let's see if it finds that. Okay, so for whatever reason, it's not showing up. Maybe it's a connectivity. No, I don't want to uninstall. What is that all about?
Yeah, you be careful before you start ruining your entire computer there.
Yeah. So let's take a look here. If I go to updates, there's a bunch of updates and stuff like that online. Yeah, but anyways, this is where you would find it. I think SQL Server Data Tool. So it's probably because I've already got it installed,
yeah,
so it's
wouldn't
not finding
come up.
But this is basically where you would find it, and you would go from there. So you're good to go. It's easy peasy.
It's easy peasy.
And it updates. It'll either install automatically for you if that's what you've set it up for, or it'll basically tell you, for example, there's an update. In this case, you can see, for example, I have updates that I need to put on. So the emulators for 8.1 for Windows Phone, as well as some things that I already have installed here, for example, as well.
So. Nice.
Yeah.
So what's on tap for October's Breakpoint?
You tell me.
You know what, though? The truth is that we always keep it a surprise anyway.
We do.
So, point being, is that make sure you stay up to date. Obviously, you're going to want to see the recording of this. So like I said, you're going to get it on Twitter. CDN Devs is the Twitter handle. BreakpointCA is the hashtag. As soon as the episode is live on demand, you're more than welcome to tune in, join it again. And of course, if you're the Facebook type, some of us are not Twitter friendly, head over to the Microsoft Developer Facebook page, facebook.com/MicrosoftDeveloper.Canada, of course. And you'll see the episode there. Feel free to post questions on there as well. Paul and I will pick it up. More importantly, so today is the 19th. In about 2 weeks or so, we'll actually have the next episode available for you to go ahead and register and make sure you join us. And we'll go from there.
Sounds like a plan.
I cannot believe that you actually, I think this is the first time in, I guess now it would be 12 episodes that you actually finished on time.
Unbelievable.
I'm going to give you a round of applause for that.
Thank you.
But that just goes to show you that it was just meant to be.
It was meant to be.
Yeah. Anyway, so until next month, we'll see you online.
Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next month.
And again, we'll be on the chat for a little bit longer. So if you have any questions, just shoot them over. But in the meantime, thanks again. Ciao. Hey, thanks for watching this episode of Breakpoint. Just wanted to remind you, you're going to do that to me right in the middle. I'm doing my spiel.
Sorry.
Okay. Anyway, as I was saying, just to remind you, if you scroll a little bit further down, there's a quick form that you can fill out. This is what I have to deal with. Anyway, there's a quick form for you to fill out that actually allows us to get in touch with you if you wanted to become the Visual Studio champion of your company. So it's really cool. Make sure you just fill it out. We'll get in touch with you. We'll give you all the information that you need. And then we can see what Visual Studio can do for you and your company.
Very cool.
Yeah. Talk to you soon.